Welcome to Soundbites, true stories told by local Mainers and nationally recognized storytellers. The themes are always changing and the hosts are from all over the nation, but when you hear the name Soundbites, you're in for a unique storytelling experience. Soundbites is made possible by the generous contributions of Allagash Brewing, Frontier, The Press Hotel, and by the listeners of Maine Public Radio. This story was told at Frontier in Brunswick, where the event's dedicated theme was seen and unseen. Here's today's host, one of Soundbite's very own producers who lives here in Portland, Donna Galuzzo.
So I want to bring it again for this next returning teller. We really tried to get him back last year, and he had a crazy year and was super busy. So I'm so glad he could make it back this year. Please give a warm welcome to Phuc Tran.
So in 1989, racism came in all colors. Some of it was of the red, white, and blue Confederate variety. It's a regular sight in our town of Carlisle, PA. But other times, racism lingered in this gray area. It's not as easy to flag the volume at which people spoke to my... Sometimes racism made us think that our antenna were a little bent, not quite dialed in, right? Like the volume at which people spoke to my parents, the way someone looked at us, the compliments on the quality of my English. Most of the time we just nodded and smiled. And then the skinheads came. Not literally, but they, the skinheads, became the boogeymen of our small town PA punk scene. As soon as my brother and I learned about punk rock, we heard about white power skinheads. What they looked like, what they listened to, what to do when you met one. And the Dead Kennedys song, Nazi Punks F*** Off, just really deepened the threat of fascism in the punk scene. My skate punk friends and I, we would regularly discuss what we would do if we ever ran into these white power skins, which was always some variation of fighting them. And we heard about this organization of independent skinheads who actively fought the white power skinheads. They were called Sharps, so skinheads against racial prejudice. Legend had it that these Sharps, these skinheads against racial prejudice, were driving white power skins out of the punk scene. And my friend Mark and I, we talked about how neither of us really wanted to be skinheads, but we definitely wanted a piece of that fight. So at our local punk shows, we were on the lookout for white power skinheads. And you could tell what they looked like. They wore red or white laces in their Doc Marten boots, and they had like iron crosses or swastikas in their flight jackets. But the rumors that these skinheads would show up always preceded their absence. We heard tales of white power shows in Lancaster, York, and Harrisburg, but in Carlisle, and at our small shows of like 25 or 30 kids, the skinheads were just a story that we told to hype ourselves up. The fights at our shows were just, usually with other punks and asshole kids from other towns, teenage scuffles over ego and turf. The fights were never that primal fight against Nazis. I mean, Nazis. We called them Nazis, as if we could like tap into the allure of that last great American war. It was so easy to hate Nazis, and we could all envision punching Nazis. Indiana Jones did it. The Von Trapps did it. Surely a few skate punks in rural PA could do it too. And I mean, let's be honest, right? The Nazi skinheads were just these cartoon cutouts, right? Two-dimensional stand-ins for a deeper and much more complicated racism in our town and in our America. But it was so easy to envision punching a Nazi and ending racism. It was like checking it off a cleaning list, right? Dust the curtains, vacuum under the bed, punch a Nazi. So the subculture chatter about Nazi skinheads erupted into the national conversation when Geraldo Rivera hosted them on his talk show in 1988. Maybe some of you remember that. Conveniently, that aired after school. So my brother and I watched transfixed, seeing real-life Nazi skinheads on TV, espousing all the racist ideologies we would have expected. During the Geraldo show, a fight broke out, and in the melee, Geraldo's nose got broken. Maybe you guys remember that. And then after the commercial break, Geraldo returned, dabbing his swollen face, his blood on his shirt. And Lou, my brother, and I looked at each other and we're like, Nazis are real. We saw them on TV. So it was against this entire cultural backdrop that we encountered this kid, Austin. So in the fall of 1989, this new kid, Austin, moved in at the end of our block. And he had all the trappings of a redneck, you know, all denim all the time, wrestling sneakers, Metallica t-shirt, Marlboros falling out of his pockets, you know, big boyish features on his man-sized head, like a sparse hint of facial hair. And, you know, my brother Lou and I, we kept our distance from rednecks in general. And we didn't introduce ourselves to him. But then we saw this iron cross on his Levi's trucker jacket, tucked in among buttons of Iron Maiden and Black Sabbath. And that was enough for my brother Lou to be convinced. He's definitely a Nazi. Did you see his iron cross? And I shook my head. Maybe he's a Nazi. We don't know. I mean, I'm not going to punch somebody that I suspect is a Nazi. I mean, what are you going to do? Ask him? My brother, who was in eighth grade at the time, did not hear that as a rhetorical question. Good idea. I am going to ask him. Plus, I heard from the other kids on the bus, he said he was white power. I was very skeptical. Really? You heard from kids on a school bus about a white supremacist living on our block? My brother Lou was undeterred. Well, I'm going to ask him tomorrow at the bus stop. And then what? If he says yes, I'm going to punch him. My brother's logic, although simple, was airtight. So the next morning, we headed off to the school bus. My brother Lou carried a roll of pennies in each hand because he had heard that punching somebody with a roll of pennies in your fist would hurt more. Austin hung out at the end of the street, headphones on. His acid wash outfit just made him seem so much taller. He was probably 6 feet tall. And the other neighborhood kids were lined up waiting for the bus, which was 15 minutes away. And Austin was leaning against a stop sign. And Lou and I dropped in at the back of the line when he dropped his backpack and cut in front of the other kids, and I followed him. And the other kids briefly protested the line cut, but when Lou and I flanked Austin, they instinctively drew a perimeter. Kids always know when a fight is coming. So Lou tapped Austin on the shoulder, and Austin looked down at him. He said, "Hey, what's up?" It's pretty friendly, right? Did not sound like a Nazi. Lou was not wasting any time. "I heard you're a Nazi, is that true?" Austin seemed very startled by the timing's question because it's 7:30 in the morning. But Lou was not screwing around because the bus is now 10 minutes away. He repeated the question. "So are you? Are you a Nazi?" We waited, and Austin looked at us both. And he replied, "Well, I used to be." His answer completely confused us. It totally bypassed this very simple flowchart that we had in our head. We had expected yes or no to the question, "Are you a Nazi?" What the hell is I supposed to do with "used to be"? I had no idea. "Used to be" meant no longer was. as far as I understood the English imperfect tense. So I used to be a Nazi meant I was no longer a Nazi, right? So the actual fight was in my head about what used to be a Nazi even really meant. But then my brother punched him anyway. It's a true story. Lou socked him as hard as he could. His fist made this hard thwack sound as Austin reeled. And Lou managed to land a few more punches, catching him off guard. You know, Austin awkwardly punched him, counterpunched him a few times. He split his brow open, and then Lou grabbed his jacket sleeve and kicked him in the side as hard as he could, and he doubled over. At this point, Austin's nose was bleeding, his face was all red. He's folded in half, and he's clutching his side. He's wheezing. I don't want to fight. What the hell? What the hell is this all about? I look at Lou, whose brow is pouring blood down the side of his face, and I tell him, you should go home and get cleaned up. There's a lot of blood. And Lou reached up and touched the side of his head and looked at his hand. It was completely crimson. And at this point, the bus is cresting the hill. So Lou picked up his backpack and, you know, he scowled at Austin one last time and headed home. And the bus pulled up just as Lou disappeared around the corner. And then the doors open and Carl, our bus driver, says, you know, calls out to us, you kids all right? And we all nodded, even though Austin's bloody nose and pummeled face told a very different story. And everybody filed on the bus in complete silence, maintaining that strict kid code of secrecy. And so when we got on the bus, Austin sat down in the seat directly in front of me. And so we had to ride to school in this tense, contorted silence. And then he turned around to talk to me. Your brother's a tough son of a bitch. He hit me really hard. Was he complimenting me? Was he complimenting Lou? Was he just like making the most awkward school bus conversation ever? I didn't know what to say. I had to say something. So I just looked at him and I said, well, don't be a f***ing Nazi. When I got home that night, my parents both yelled at me for not protecting Lou, who sat at the kitchen table glumly. He looked way worse than when I'd seen him that morning. He had like red and purple splotches on his face. He had 5 stitches above his eye. And I told him, I was like, dude, you are a legend. Everyone heard about the fight. You beat up an 11th grader. That is what everyone is saying. And he couldn't even look at me. He just mumbled, oh yeah, really? You know, he was pissed. He was pissed that I hadn't jumped in to help him punch a Nazi. You know, my brother went out there to the school bus with his fists wrapped around penny rolls, ready to crush fascism. And I, his older brother, just stood dumbly by trying to parse the grammar Nazi. And what they don't tell you, what people don't tell you about punching a Nazi is what you do after you punch the Nazi. Because my brother Lou had punched a Nazi. And then we still had to ride the school bus every day with him. The following week, Austin, on the school bus, in front of me, Lou, and the rest of the kids on the bus, he called out to us, hey, Fook and Lou, check it out. And he held up his backpack, on which he had scrawled in black permanent marker, Nazis, f*** off. And Lou and I looked at it and shrugged. That's cool. I mean, we didn't really know what to say. I mean, we thought he was still a dick for having ever been a Nazi, but now that he said he wasn't, were we willing to leave him alone? I had no idea. This was far more complicated than the cartoonish justice of punching a Nazi. After that morning, after the bus ride that morning, I headed over to my friend's meetup place. And my friend Aaron was finishing up his last cigarette before class, and he broke off his conversation to ask me about my brother Lou. Hey, how's your brother doing? Still can't believe he beat up that Nazi prick. So badass. And everybody in the circle nodded their heads, and I nodded along. Yeah, thanks for, you know, thanks for asking. He's all right. His face is, like, super busted up. And Aaron kept talking. You know, you and your brother should just shave your heads and be those, like, anti-racist skinheads, you know, like, you know, join the Sharps. You know, and I shook my head. Nah, it's okay. Skinheads aren't for me. And then Aaron started laughing. You know, wait, no, yeah, you guys could be like Asian power skinheads. And Mark and Jim chuckled at the idea, which egged Aaron on. Yeah, Asian power skinheads? Instead of white laces in your Doc Martens, you could wear like yellow laces. And then everybody was laughing. And then I glared at Aaron and I shot back, well, why stop there with the yellow laces? Why don't I just wear noodle laces? And then the entire group erupted with laughter, and they gave me high fives for the joke. And I won the game. I won the game by hating myself most. So the bell rang for homeroom, and we all lumbered across the street. And Aaron put his hand on my shoulder. You know, we're just f***ing with you, right? Screw those Nazis. They're the racist assholes. And I nodded silently. It was so easy to hate Nazis, so easy to hate racist assholes. But us, we weren't the racists. We were the ones who fought racists. At least that was the lie that everyone told themselves. Everyone, including myself. Thanks.
A little bit more about Fook. He's a classicist and a tattooer. In 2010, he served on the committee to revise the National Latin Praxis Exam. He currently teaches in Portland, Maine. His TEDx talk on grammar and identity was featured on NPR's TED Radio Hour. As a tattooer, Fook owns Tsunami Tattoo, another incredible Portland business. And he's been featured in national tattoo publications, and he's been quoted in the Christian Science Monitor and Time magazine. His memoir, forthcoming on Flatiron Books, is about growing up in a rural town as a nerdy Asian punk rocker who would eventually become a Latin teaching tattooer. Awesome. Woo!
We went backstage before the show to catch up with today's storyteller. They shared some personal tidbits that aren't included in their story.
So, what is your connection to Maine?
Well, I live here. You know, I saw this bumper sticker once that said, I'm not from here, but I moved here as fast as I could. So, yeah, I guess I usually just connect myself to my wife, who is a real Mainer. So anytime anyone calls into question my credentials for being here, I just throw myself behind her and then let her do all the heavy lifting. So yeah, my wife, Susan Tran.
That's awesome. I, too, connect myself to my wife is a real Mainer from Caribou, so I totally get what you're saying. What got you into storytelling?
I think just the invitation from someone to tell a story. I don't think I ever thought of myself as a storyteller, and I just didn't. I was like, oh, somebody wants to hear me tell a story. Sure, I'll tell a story. It's also, like, not a natural mode for me. I think it's terrifying and daunting, and I love it. You know what? Yeah, I just love doing things that scare me. So getting up in front of people and humiliating myself, yeah, sure, let's do it.
All right. What is your process for preparing to tell your story?
It's pretty, I don't know, it works for me. I think it's probably more labor intensive than some other people. And I think it's partly because I don't trust myself I write it basically. So I write it all out. I sort of read through it and then I memorize it as a story. And then I kind of like work through a self-direction and get feedback from my wife who, yeah, super helpful. I don't know. Everyone's different though. I it's really interesting.
It definitely is really interesting. So is there a part of your story that you can tell us about, some sort of a behind the scenes detail that you're not actually including in the story tonight?
Yes, actually, it's actually a detail I had to drop just for time. But it makes me really sad because it refers to someone writing the word Nazis in the plural. And they use the apostrophe, so it's Nazi apostrophe S for plural, not possessive, and it just kills me. And I really wanted to talk about that a lot, but I just couldn't for time.
Thanks, Luke.
Soundbites is made possible by the generous contributions of Allagash Brewing, Frontier, The Press Hotel, and by the listeners of Maine Public Radio. Special thanks also to Toad & Co. More information about Soundbites, including how to attend a live storytelling event, is online at soundbitesme.org. And of course, you can always hear more stories at mainepublic.org.